A little baseball first, and the state of labor talks. The two sides got together last week. Are they on track to at least avoid missing regular season games if they can get something together? And what's the timeline for that?
Yeah, that's hard to determine how this is going to go, obviously, Rich. But my stance has been for a while that I don't think we'll see anything impact the start of the regular season. But I think it's almost inevitable at this point that we have a delayed start to spring training. If you start, you know, reverse engineering the timeline, we're less than a month now from the start of spring training. At least pitchers and catchers reporting right around the middle of the month. And when you think about everything that's got to be done, let's start with the most obvious, which is reaching an agreement, and that's obviously nowhere near in sight, though they can make up a lot of ground in a hurry. But even once that's done, there's a laundry list of other things that has to happen. You know, you've got to get players to travel to Florida and Arizona and have intake and everything else in the middle of a continuing pandemic. You've got salary arbitration that has to be done for hundreds of players. You've got Rule 5. You've got almost 200 players who are unsigned and free agents. So there's a lot that has to be done even after they reach an agreement on a new labor deal. And obviously, you know, that's going to take some time. So it's hard to imagine all of that getting done in time for a February 15th, give or take a couple of days or so, opening of camp in both Florida and Arizona. I think it's far more likely we have a condensed, hurry-up kind of spring training, maybe one that starts around the 1st of March.
Now, last week, apparently, Major League Baseball came in and talked about some things of concern to the MLBPA, free agency, salaries, restructuring the draft to try and discourage tanking. Was there anything new on the table in those discussions?
Yeah, I mean, it seems that baseball is that owners and the commissioner are willing to improve the minimum salary for first and second year players. It's really quite low now, particularly when you compare it to other teams. And that's what we always have to do, and make sure that people don't think that we're saying that $575,000 a year represents poverty wages. We're talking about the pro sports world, not the real world. So there's been some movement there, which I think the union is encouraged by. But you know, the changes that the union is seeking, both in arbitration and in free agency, where they want to arrive at both of those earlier, those are not going to be easy gets from the owners, nor are some changes they want to see involving tanking, although the suggestions by the owners to go to a draft lottery at least is a small step, but the Players Association also wants some changes in terms of revenue sharing. Owners have been highly resistant to that. So I would say if we're moving these talks to a football gridiron, let's say that they got out of the shadow of their own end zone, but not by much.
All right, we're talking with Sean McAdam here on Downtown. Where is their common ground? Is it likely that the universal DH will come into play this season?
Yeah, that seems obvious. Both sides want it. Should have been obvious for 2021, but it didn't get done there. I think the only hitch is if the owners again overstate the willingness of the players to just agree to that without having some trade-off. But that's a minor thing. I don't think there's anyone involved in these talks who believes that there isn't going to be a universal DH for 2022 and going forward. I think we've seen the last of pitchers hitting in Major League Baseball.
Now, I might be in the minority on this, but I actually grew to like putting a man on second base in extra innings, but it sounds like that may not come back.
Yeah, I think a couple of things that got introduced because of the pandemic, the seven-inning doubleheaders, the ghost runner in extra innings, things like that are very much in jeopardy. I'm with you. I speak somewhat selfishly as someone who has seen too many 15-inning games and blown deadlines and leaving the ballpark at 1:30 a.m., so I have some self-interest here, but I think I don't think anybody, you know, if you want to maybe start it in the 11th inning on the ghost runner and play the 10th inning, not unlike sort of what the NHL does, where you have an overtime period, and then if that doesn't work, you go to the gimmicky shootout. You want to call the ghost runner a gimmick and play one inning before you get there, that's fine, but I think fans and players alike are best served by, you know, eliminating the possibility for endless extra inning games.
Well, not only that, but as kind of an old school guy, I like that quite often it meant that teams would get back to playing small ball and not just swing for the fences. You would see a sacrifice or a hit and run.
Yeah, there was a little sense of urgency to those games where the visiting team not only wanted to get one run home, but often tried to protect themselves by getting two, realizing how relatively easy it is to score when you begin the inning with a runner on second base in scoring position. So it does provide that sense of urgency, I think, to the games in extra innings rather than treating the 10th inning as, you know, a simple extension of the regular season game and nobody's in any hurry to try to win it. That gets changed with the runner starting at second.
Next week, the Baseball Hall of Fame will announce this year's class. If there is one, do you think anybody actually gets the 75% needed to get in?
I think Ortiz is going to get in by a whisker. I think it's going to be close, but I think he will gain election. I think a lot of people, watching the Hall of Fame tracker under the Twitter handle Not Mr. Tibbs. For those of your listeners who aren't familiar with it, I would urge them to check it out. It's a compendium of people making their ballots public as we go in real time, so we have a sense. It's sort of like we see on election night in real elections where you have some early results coming in and you can judge how things are going to go from there. He's tracking at over 80% so far. Usually the votes that get made public earlier tend to come from younger voters, present company excluded, it seems sufficiently clear of the 75% threshold needed that even if Ortiz loses some support from older voters who are troubled by either the DH thing, which I find ludicrous at this point. It's been a approved position in the game for almost 50 years now. It might be time for people to get over that particular bias. But older voters often are tougher to convince when it comes to any PED allegations, and Ortiz having supposedly tested positive on the trial run there in 2003 is probably going to lose some votes there, but it looks like it's enough that he's accumulated enough already that he's probably going to be safe, and although not much margin for error. I thought going in that Curt Schilling was going to gain election needing only, 14, 15 votes last year. Usually when players get that close near the end of their eligibility, They get swept in on that final year. We saw that happen with Larry Walker. We've seen it happen with others. It does not appear to be happening with Schilling. I think whether it was passive aggressive on his part or part of some bigger strategy, but his plea to be taken off the ballot and saying he didn't want to be voted in by writers has been taken to heart by some. And last I saw, he's lost almost 20 votes. So it seems clear Schilling's not getting in. And while I think Bonds and Clemens will get closer than the 61% or so they were at last year, I don't think it's enough to make up the 14% that they need. So it looks like Ortiz is the only one getting in, and even that, as we've said, is not a slam dunk.
We're talking with Sean McAdam on Downtown. When things start up again, when the lockout ends, what do the Red Sox have their eye on? You mentioned a large number of free agents out there. Anything in particular they would be looking for?
Well, we'll have to see where the Seiya Suzuki posting process takes us. That has used up its first 10 days. It is traditionally 30 days long, so there's going to be, that's another thing that's going to be, have to get done in a relatively compressed schedule post-agreement. They certainly are involved and very much are interested in landing him, whether he chooses here or someplace else, we'll see. That would fill one of the needs they have now, which is a right-handed hitting outfielder. Absent that, there's not a whole lot that I could see them doing free agent-wise from the right-hand side. They could still pursue Kyle Schwarber as a lefty bat. But one way or another, you would think they would need an outfielder to essentially fill in what's been lost with the trade of Hunter Renfro. And then I think they need at least one, if not two, established bullpen arms. It would be nice if that person had some closing experience, because that seems unsettled, given you're not sure what they're going to get out of Matt Barnes going forward. But either way, I think they need one, probably two, high-leverage guys, and there are a few people out there, including a guy like Colin McHugh, who was here in 2020, opted out of the season, but would, you know, provide some innings and perhaps free up either Garrett Whitlock and or Tanner Houck to graduate to the rotation. So bullpen and an outfielder, the latter of which preferably right-handed, would seem to be what's on the shopping list remaining.
Sean McAdam, Boston Sports Journal, visiting with us this afternoon. Sean, we appreciate it. As always, good talking with you, and we'll catch up with you again before too long.
Look forward to it, Rich. Thanks for having me.
Sean McAdam.